Good morning, everyone. So today is our last day of the semester, last year of the semester. And so there are a lot of things I want to do today. I'm not sure if we'll do all of them. First of all, we need to address a number of the unresolved questions we have from last week and the Rambam's position about Hashgacha. I'm in Shira, darling. Correct. I'm not the only one teaching from home today. Sorry. And the second thing is that I'd like to discuss the Ramban's complex position on Hashgacha and even introduce the approach of the Baal Shem Tov and Rav Dessler. But first, since it's the last year of the Zman, I want to give a hakdama to talk about what we're trying to do here every Friday. And it's a funny thing to give the hakdama on the last day, but I'm going to do it anyway because of two questions I got yesterday, or really not entirely yesterday, but recently. One was yesterday that relate to what we're doing over here today. Not just today, every day. So Baruch Hashem, as many of you know, I just was zocha to put out a sefer on Machshava, the second volume in a series. Be'ezras Hashem, if anybody wants to buy that at a discounted price for Talmidim and Ashir, I'll be able to do that, sell that to you maybe next week or 2 weeks or when you get back if you're away for winter break. But the question that someone asked, seeing the sefer basically, is, you know, why in the world does it have to be so long? Why does it have to be so long-winded? And that's relevant for us. You know, we've been talking about Shitas HaRambam, about Hashgacha, for example. And, you know, we didn't just summarize his view in a minute or 2 minutes or 5 minutes. We have all these questions. We're going to suggest some answers today. Maybe the answers are good. Maybe they're lousy. You know, well, why does it have to be so long-winded? Why can't it just be straightforward, short? That's the first question I want to talk to you about today. And the second question is a different question someone asked. Which is, do we really answer the questions in the Shir? Are we going to be answering the most pressing questions that people really have? So let's talk about the first one. Why does it have to be so long? So certainly there is beauty in brevity. And there's also much that's lost in brevity, the details, the subtlety, the diversity of perspectives. Long-windedness could come at a cost. If you don't listen to a whole answer, then you'll not have the answers to your questions. But at the same time, sometimes a short answer won't really answer the question. And I saw a very interesting thing. The Rambam addresses this in Mor Nevuchim, Chilak Aleph Perak Lamed Aled, which you have on the source sheets for today. Or you can download them from the class website. The Rambam writes in Mor Nevuchim over there, he's discussing why so few people arrive at the correct understanding, especially in the field of Machshava. And his answer basically is because it takes a lot of time. And most people lack patience. And more specifically, he writes that people want so much to reach the goal that what's the goal? The answers to these pressing questions that so many of us have, that they have no patience for the process, which is often long and tedious. So this is what the Rambam writes. See it over here. The preparatory studies, here he means for metaphysics, are of long duration, and man in his natural desire to reach the goal, finds them frequently too wearisome and does not wish to be troubled by them. Suppose you awaken any person, even the most simple, from his sleep, and you say to him, "Do you want to know what the heavens are, their number, their forms, what's contained in them, what the angels are, the creation, when it took place, how, what was its purpose, the relationship of the parts of the universe to each other, what's the nature of the soul, how does it enter the body, does it have an independent existence, so on and so forth." You wake up someone in the middle of the night and say, "You know, do you want to understand how the universe works? Do you want to know why we're here? Do you want to know the answer to the problem of evil?" All the most basic questions. So, of course, everybody's going to say, "Yes, yes, I really want to know the answer." And they're going to show a natural desire for true knowledge of these things. And then, if you tell him that, well, but he will wish to satisfy that desire and to attain to that knowledge by listening to a few words from you. Ask him to interrupt his usual pursuits for a week till he learn all this. He wouldn't do it. Say, "You know what? Okay, I'll answer your questions, but you know what? You have to stop whatever you're doing and learn for a week." And he would be satisfied and contented with imaginary and misleading notions. He would refuse to believe that there's anything which requires preparatory studies and persevering research. In other words, everybody wants the answers to their question. But if you tell them you got to work on it, and it takes time, and it's hard, no, not interested. You know, people think that the need for short answers and sound bites is a modern problem. It's the internet, smartphones, it's our ever-decreasing attention span. That's the problem. And there might be some truth to that. But the Rambam writes that he had the same problem. He has all this knowledge he wants to teach, answers to all these questions. But almost nobody is willing to take the time to work on it and actually get the answers to the questions. They're very happy to raise the questions, but they're not interested in the work that's needed to answer the questions. And the Rambam continues and he says, you know, but there are a few people, what he calls Hasridim Asher Hashem Korei, pasuk from Yoel, the remnant of people who Hashem calls, and they attain Shlemus, because they put the work into it. And that type of preparation is necessary for the real acquisition of knowledge. And he quotes the pasuk in Shlomo that highlights this. Shema etza v'kabel musar l'man tachkam b'acharisecha. Listen to advice, take musar, so that you'll become wise in the end. In the end. In other words, don't expect to have the answers immediately. But in the end, if you work on it, you'll get there. So the answer is that sometimes it would be much easier to just present every sugya b'kitzer, the cliff note version. And it's easier because it takes less time. It's not as tedious. Everything's wrapped up in a nice package. Every answer is neatly packaged, but the Rambam tells you that if you want to arrive at the truth to the extent possible, you have to be willing to invest in the process. Obviously, just going to a shiur on Friday isn't going to do the trick. It's a beginning, but if this is something that interests you, so then it's well worth the investment. The second question that I want to talk about is do we really answer the questions? Do we really answer the questions? many people have pressing questions. Does studying Machshava provide the answers to these questions? So recently, last Motzei Shabbos, I saw a fascinating statement by Rav Eliyahu Weintraub. Rabbi Weintraub, he passed away 10 years ago or so. He was one of the greatest Mekubalim alive, and perhaps the greatest Mekubal that was in the Litvish Yeshivish Welt. In other words, there are many great Sephardi Mekubalim and Hasidish Mekubalim, but he certainly lived in Bnei Brak, one of the great. He's from America. He started off in Chaim Berlin. And he quotes from the Leshem, who quotes from, Leshem was perhaps the greatest in the last century and a half, Litvish Mekubal. He's from Lithuania. He was Rav Kook's Rebbe in Kabbalah. He did move to Eretz Yisrael with Rav Kook's help. And he quotes, the Leshem quotes from Rebbe Yisrael Salanter, who...
Rebbe, do you have the Nashi, the Leshem?
No. This is, I didn't, it's, the citation, it's in a book called, right here, Nefesh Eliyahu, which is Shiurim from Rav Weintraub. And what I'm about to quote is from page Dalid. If you want to look it up, it's page Dalid in the Akdama. So we're towards the beginning of the book. But I didn't put it in the sheets. But so he quotes from the Leshem, from Yisrael Salanter, the following, that from the year 56, let me try to close this door, I'll get a little more quiet. From the year 5600, approximately 1840, the gates of wisdom were open to become available to the public. The number 5600 is from the Zohar, which you can, which I did put on your sheets. You could see that over here. The Zohar writes that Uvashis Me'ashanin L'Shisisa, meaning on the 600th year of the 6th millennium, so that's 5600, Yispatchon Tar'e D'Chachmesa L'Ela, Mivui D'Chachmesa L'Tasa. The upper gates of wisdom are going to be opened, and the wellsprings of wisdom from below, Ein Sha. So this means that at this time, Chachma will become a certain type of chachma, what will become public. So Salanter said, why? What happened? What happened in 5600? Why was this so important? And he said, because this is a time when heresy, when kfira, became dominant. It's in many ways the dominant perspective in our world. And that opening, I'll read you his Lashon. This is the quote from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Sha'ad shnas tafresh haya ha'esek b'zeh shayach rak liyachidim. U'mishnas tafresh niftachu sha'rei ha'chachma liyos neches harabim. V'zeh mipnei shehagzeros la'orech ha'galos haya shmados v'nisyono shel kfira chas v'shalom. Aval mitkufa hanal hischil matzav shel kfira mamish ba'olam. B'zeh u'mazeh asa alokim, v'niftachu sha'rei chachma, l'man yuchlu ha'shlemim l'schazei k'negdu b'limud omek v'sisrei ha'toyra k'dosha. So, zeh u'mazeh, in a time where kfira would become prevailing, dominant, so Hashem opened up certain wellsprings of chachma to combat that. So I want to try to understand this, because does this type of chachma that opened up, whether it's Kabbalah, you know, in this almost, you know, 180 years since that time, the tremendous development of machshava, of chassidus, does that answer the questions? Someone who's is a kofar, struggling with the kfira, and he had these questions. Really, difficult questions. Does God exist? Torah Misinai, the problem of evil. Does learning Machshava, will that answer their questions? So Rav Aaron Lapiansky, my Rebbe, said that you can answer a question from Kfira in two ways. One way is directly. The Rambam, for example, the Guide to the Perplexed, was written to address the issues of Kfira that were prevalent in his time. And there are questions, and he gives answers. How do I know God exists? The Rambam has four proofs for the existence of God. He addresses the questions sometimes by showing that the Torah is actually consistent with the prevailing scientific and philosophical perspectives. What you think the Torah means is really not what the Torah means. What the Torah means is consistent with philosophy. Sometimes it's by rejecting philosophy, like he did with respect to Abriya Yeshmeayin. But there are questions, and he provides answers. Like we said before, sometimes the answers take a long time to get there. You know, we've been talking about Hashgacha, more than 10 chapters in the Mar Nevuchim, hard chapters on Hashgacha. But there are questions, and for the most part, he answers the questions. That's one way to address Kfira. Rav Moshe Shapiro, I don't know if any of you guys were zocha to hear him. I was zocha to attend a number of his shiurim. And he was zocha to bring many, many people close to Torah. People with questions and bring them close to Torah. But it was rarely because he answered their questions, at least in a direct way. His shiurim were never, okay, here's the kaina that they have, okay, and here's our answer. Very rarely, if ever. So how did he do it? Answer is that when we study Machshava, and this Asek has really blossomed in the last couple of centuries. So it explains to us the Torah's wisdom in a way that we never understood before. It opens our eyes to its beauty. You look at an Agadata Gemara, and it's so mysterious. Sometimes it even looks silly, superficial, irrelevant. And then you learn, you would go to Rav Moshe Shiurim and you hear his explanation of what Chazal really meant in that Medrash, in that Gemara, in that Zohar. And you're like, wow, that's incredible. It opens up our eyes to what the Torah means. It illuminates the vagaries of life and history. And most importantly, it gives meaning and direction to our lives. And it does that even though you might not have the answer to your question at the end of the day. You might still have that question. But your faith in the system, and the truth of Torah and the Dvar Hashem is strengthened because you see in it such incredible wisdom. So that's our goal when we learn Machshava. We actually try to do both. We try to answer the questions. And sometimes we'll find answers that we find satisfactory, and sometimes we won't. But hopefully, by studying these sugyas, by realizing and appreciating the depth, the profundity, the beauty of Torah, so that will help us, if not always answer the question, but live with the questions and strengthen our emunah and come closer to our HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's really what we're trying to do here. So now back to where we are. So what would I like to do again? Since this last time, I'm going to try to finish up the Rambam briefly. Then maybe we'll introduce the Ramban and probably won't, we'll see how far we get. So if you remember, we worked on the Rambam last time and we saw a number of questions. And let's review some of the questions that we saw and see if we have any ideas. So if you look on the sheets, not this week's sheets, but last week's sheets, so we noted a number of questions. I think four questions in particular. Again, you have them in your sheets. The Rambam basically says four things, and we need to figure out how they relate to each other. In 3:17, he absolutely affirmed divine justice. Nobody ever suffers unjustly. In 3:17 and 3:18, he maintains that Hashkacha is naturalistic through the intellect connecting to the Ribono Shel Olam. In other words, as opposed to supernaturalistic, constant nisim interventions, it's natural through the connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In 3:51, he elaborates on this point. He writes, therefore, that someone who is constantly contemplating the divine will be spared from nature. They'll be protected from nature because since they're constantly connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so they'll experience constant hashkacha. And he writes that this is the madrega of the Avos and Moshe Rabbeinu, who even when they were involved in the world, they still continued to have that connection. They had no Hesach Hadas from thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And finally, in 3:23, when the Rambam discusses the whole Sefer Iyov, he seems to conclude that the lesson that Iyov learns in the end of the day is that a person may experience hardship. They may be sick. They may lose their money. They may lose their family. But if you value what's eternal, then you'll be able to endure that affliction. So there's no guarantee that connecting to the Ribono Shel Olam will protect you from these things. These afflictions might happen, but they won't stop a person from true happiness, because the happiness comes from having connected to the Ribono Shel Olam, from valuing that which is eternal. It's really a question of attitude, much more than protection. So these are the four statements that I want to work on with you. Now, I think essentially there are two contradictions. The first relates to the scope of providence, and the second relates to justice. So what's the first contradiction? The first contradiction is that assertion number four seems to contradict two and three, namely that assertions two and three indicate that harm will not befall a person who is righteous, who's connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Rambam even writes in 3:51 that when misfortunes occur to tzaddikim, it's because they had that Hesach Hadas. And during the Hesach Hadas, the Hashkacha withdraws. But in 3:23, he implies that everybody experiences misfortune, even when they're connected to the Ribono Shel Olam. It's just that you won't be devastated by it if you have the proper attitude. That's That's the stira. Or to put it differently, in 323, the Rambam states that Eov's great epiphany is recognizing that suffering is something unfathomable. Whereas in 351, he resolves all doubts by suggesting that misfortune can only occur when a person ceases contemplation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and breaks that bond between himself and his creator. That's stira number one. Stira number two is that assertions 2, 3, and 4 contradict number one. Because number one guarantees absolute justice. Nobody will ever get anything they don't deserve. Now, you could only guarantee not getting anything you don't deserve if you assume total hashkacha. At least that's what I would think. In other words, nature is unfair. The results are sometimes unjust. So you have a person who's not contemplating God all the time. What's going to happen? They're going to suffer. And that suffering might not be fair. How could it be just? Just because I stopped thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, does that mean I deserve whatever suffering might come? Chas v'shalom. So that's the second question. Second question is, how does 2, 3, and 4 are soser 1? And the first question is, 4 is soser 2 and 3. Now, Reb Shmuel Ibn Tibon, in a letter to the Rambam in 1199, was bothered by these same questions. Remember, Reb Shmuel Ibn Tibon was Rambam's preferred translator. He lived, I believe, in Provence, and he translated the Mor Nevuchim and other works from Arabic, Judeo-Arabic, to Hebrew. And he understood 323, that's the Rambam's interpretation of Eov, as saying there is no personal hashkacha. That's the way the Ibn Tibbon understood the Rambam. And so he said, and he actually understood also, that's what the Rambam meant in 317, that a person who's perfected their intellect won't suffer due to mikra. Doesn't mean that they won't be left to mikra. It means that mikra won't bother them. And so he writes that this contradicts the Rambam's latter position in 351, where he writes that the chassid will be protected from mikra. In other words, basically, Ibn Tibbon understands the earlier chapters. He says it's basically three chapters, 16 through 23, as stating that providence for the perfected individual, like Eov after his revelation, as only providing intellectual immunity from evil and suffering, whereas the latter chapter, 351, implies total protection. So he writes to the Rambam that, you know, I want clarifications. He says, I'm a navoch, and I want answers. Kilo amar adonenu yarum hodo sheba'od shelo yeda bore yedia mitis bo alav osam haraos avo achar sheyada Hashem, after Eov knew Hashem. This is a part of the sefer in that we didn't really talk about last week, but part of what the Rambam says is that Eov originally believed in God, not because he discovered God or he had proof for God's existence, but simply because he was told, and then he discovered God independently, which is a more direct form of knowledge. That's once he knew Hashem, bad couldn't come on him, not because it wouldn't actually come, but because he wouldn't be bothered by it. Lo chashash bo alav shum davar mikol ma shaba. Rambam is medayik that at the beginning of the book of Eov, it says Eov was Yari Shamayim, he's a great tzaddik, but it doesn't say he was a chacham, because he wasn't a chacham, and he became a chacham by the end. So that's the stira, more or less, that Ibn Tibbon presents. Now, we don't, sadly, have Rambam's response to this letter to Ibn Tibbon. But we do actually have a response for a different letter that Ibn Tibbon had sent the Rambam, in which Ibn Tibbon asks to visit the Rambam to ask him questions concerning Mor Nevuchim. So he has a bunch of questions that I want to ask. I'm trying to translate the Rambam, and I have some questions, and I want to ask you them in person. It's a long trip from Europe to Egypt, but he was willing, happy to make that trip, so he could ask the Rambam these questions. So the Rambam does respond. We have this response, and it's actually a fascinating letter. I'll read you part of it. The Rambam basically tells him, don't come, I'm too busy. If you come, I won't even have time to see you. So it's a waste of your time. I dwell in Misr, which is Fostat, and the Sultan resides in Cairo. These two places are 4,000 amos from each other. My duties at the Sultan are very heavy. I'm obligated to visit him every day, early in the morning. And when he or any of his children or any of their inmates in his harem are indisposed, I can't leave. I must stay most of the day at the palace and attend to their needs and heal them and alike. Then I leave. I come home in the afternoon. I'm almost dying with hunger. I find the antechambers filled with people, both Jews and Gentiles, noble and common people, judges and bailiffs, friends and foes, a mixed multitude who wait the time of my return, right? So I'm coming home from work and I see this long line of people waiting to see me for medical attention. I think that might be because the Rambam was a great doctor, and it might also be because the Rambam held that it's usher to charge money for medicine, so it's free. Anyhow, he writes that I dismount from my animal, I wash my hands, go forth to my patients. You see, it's important to wash your hands before you see your patients, and entreat them to bear with me while I eat something, the only meal I take in 24 hours. Then I go forth to attend to my patients and write prescriptions. Patients go in and out until nightfall and sometimes even afterwards. I solemnly assure you until 2 or more hours in the night, I converse and prescribe while laying down from sheer fatigue. In other words, I can't even, I can't even sit. I'm so exhausted. I just lay down in my bed and I try to treat them. I'm so tired, I can't even talk. In consequence of this, no Israelite can have any private interview with me except on Shabbos. On that day, the whole congregation, or most of them, come after Shul, and I give a shiur. We learn till noon and they depart. Some of them return in the afternoon for another shiur and stay till Maariv. That's how I spend my days. So Mr. Ibn Tibbon, Rabbi Ibn Tibbon, don't bother coming. I don't have any time to talk to you. So we don't know. We don't know the answer that the Rambam gave to these questions. Ibn Tibbon himself preferred to resolve the questions by assuming that Rambam really believed in Aristotle's position. The basis is his comments in 323, and he has a very far-fetched interpretation how to explain everything else in light of that. I think that his interpretation is dochak, certainly in terms of 351, but just as much in terms of 317 and 318. The truth is that 317 and 318, I think, like we suggested last week, are totally parallel to 351. They both assume that there's hashkacha. In terms of the kasha from his interpretation of Eov, I don't know. I don't hear the kasha so much because lemaisa, the Rambam writes in 317, 318, 351, that someone who does have hesach hadas from contemplating the divine will sometimes experience tragedy and hardship and suffering. And memela, that's why we need the answer, the lesson of 323, what Eov learns, which is that you have to learn to be able to put things into perspective and remain close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even when you do experience suffering. And that's exactly what Hashem tells Eov. He says, you're not going to be able to understand everything that happens to you, because you're not always connected to me. And sometimes, therefore, you're subject to the randomness of nature. And what you can do, though, is rise to a level where you're going to be able to take these things in perspective. So to summarize, this is basically the second kasha we raised is not such a kasha in my view. There's no stira between 323 and 351 or even 317. In all cases, he's saying, look, you know, there's two ways that we could deal with and we should deal with hardship. Number one is psychologically, we have to have the proper perspective on things. And number two is to the extent to which that we can connect to the Ribono Shel Olam will also be spared. The bigger question to me is dealing with justice in 317. I think that was the first question. This is the second question. And that's because since Lamaisa, most people aren't constantly connected to God, so they're naturally subject to the whims of nature. And doesn't that indicate that people will undeservingly suffer? So how does the Rambam stem that with what he says, that nobody ever suffers unjustly? So this is, I think, a harder question. You know, one solution is to suggest that such people do suffer justly. Their experiences are a fair consequence for their failure to utilize the magnificent gift that Hashem gave them, their intellect, their ability to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, their neshama. So the fact that they suffer is fair. It's not a contradiction to justice because they were also given the tools to avoid that. I don't think that's a very satisfying answer. Some people experience torturous pain, and their failure to take advantage of God's invitation hardly seems to account for their searing agony. And not everybody is capable of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the same way without Hesach Hadas, especially in an intellectual way. Another solution could be that God intervenes to prevent unjust suffering. In other words, basically both things are true. There's justice and there's teva. And a person will suffer sometimes because of teva. But were someone to be suffering unjustly, in other words, if somebody was about to get thrown around in a tornado, and Hashem sees that they're undeserving of that, so then he would intervene and make sure it doesn't happen. So they're both true. There is justice, there is nature, and to the extent there's a stira, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be miyashiv the stira, will make sure that a person doesn't suffer unjustifiably. A nace, basically. Now, the Rambam does say, generally speaking, that God intervenes naturalistically, as we saw last week. But he does occasionally perform nisim, as we saw last week as well. The Rambam unabashedly affirms his belief in nisim. So, accordingly, the Rambam would be saying that should someone suffer, then Hashem would have no choice but to intervene in the event that was undeserving. This answer, I think, is also difficult because the Rambam seems to prefer to avoid such direct intervention as much as possible, certainly not on a regular basis. The Rambam does not seem to see the world as constant nisim. Okay, so what else could we say? Another suggestion, we could deny the injustice. We could say that it might seem that the righteous are suffering. In fact, whatever pain they experience serves some purpose and is in some way just. But again, I don't think this is what the Rambam holds, because the Rambam quotes this view. He associates it, as we saw last week, with the Mutazili and the Mutazila say this, and he says it's wrong. He says it doesn't make sense. It doesn't explain everything. So it seems that, in fact, there are times that the innocent suffer due to exposure to nature. But didn't the Rambam say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is absolutely just? The answer is, perhaps, that the Rambam writes that, what does he reject? Let's look at it a little more carefully. He categorically rejects the possibility that God would cause a person to suffer unjustly, even if it's just so he gets rewarded in the world to come. Remember, that was his understanding of Yisur Chalava, which he rejects. But in this case, it's not God causing them to suffer. It's nature, or it's free will if someone decides to hurt them. God created a world in which there is such a thing as nature, in which there is such a thing as free will. And part of that involves God, people suffering. Now, in some way, that is attributable to God. The Pasuk says, Yeshayahu Yotzer Or, Uvorei Choshech, Oseh Shalom, Uvorei Eshara. What does it mean, Borei Eshara? What does it mean, Borei Choshech? The Rambam writes, fascinatingly, that the word Borei in this context doesn't mean a direct creation. Hashem doesn't create evil. And he doesn't even create darkness. Darkness, according to the Rambam, is just the absence of light. So he creates light. Darkness is memela. Rambam thinks that's the difference between the word yotzer and borei. Borei could refer to a negation. It's a big machlokas between the Rambam and the Mekubalim. The Rambam talks about this in Bereishis and in Parshas Bo, Rabbeinu Bachya and others. It's another sugya. But the point is that yes, Hashem created a world. Hashem created the best possible world. In the best possible world, there's free will. And part of free will mean that sometimes you're going to be hurt. Hashem will never cause a person to suffer unfairly, but in the case where they're subject to free will, that's not Hashem doing it. Hashem's doing it indirectly, but not directly. And the same thing with nature. At the same time, Hashem, within the laws of nature, allows a person to transcend nature's dominion over them by connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In that case, they won't be subject to the whims of happenstance. Rambam told us everybody does this, or most people could do it while learning, while davening. Extraordinary people do it even while engaging in the world. And the Rambam also tells us that, like we said before, for people who nevertheless do experience it, if they have the proper attitude towards it, it won't cause them that much suffering. And finally, ultimately, there is going to be din and there is going to be justice. And our existence is not limited to the world. And we will be rewarded for our zechuyos and we'll suffer for our averos. And there will ultimately be justice. And that's what the Rambam means when he says nobody will ultimately suffer unjustly. And certainly that Hashem does not cause in a direct way that unjust suffering. That's, I think, what the Rambam holds. Now, we're going to have a chance, not sure yet, I haven't decided, maybe next month we'll continue talking a little bit about Hashgacha, because I did want to do Ramban with you, and I did want to do more contemporary thinkers, I want to do the Baal Shem Tov, we'll see. But as you all know, many, many contemporary thinkers, I think this is even the without doubt, the dominant school of thought nowadays, certainly reject this idea of the Rambam. And maybe even the Ramban. Question we could talk about another time is why is it that so many of the Achronim seem to be going against the Rishonim? Not for now. And I assume that everything is Hashgacha. That everything is Hashgacha. There's no such thing as Teva. Teva, according to Rav Dessler, is an illusion. It's not real. Really, everything is is totally and directly coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Teva is a mask, so the Baal Shem Tov says as well. Everything is Hashgacha. So there's Nafkamina. There's Nafkamina. We have this big debate. Everybody always talks about a tremendous machlokas between some Rishonim who hold of a more limited approach to Hashgacha. Not everything is from Hashem. Such a thing as Teva, nature. Some who hold everything is Hashgacha. Is there a Nafkamina? But my Nafkamina. So I remember Rav Tversky once suggested that he thinks that this debate is largely philosophical and has little practical relevance, because either way, our response to suffering is the same. Like we talked about in the opening shiurim on Hashgacha, Yisurin ban liyadcha yifashvish b'maisav. A person, according to the Rambam, might never know whether a mishap that they just experienced was a result of chance or divine act of reward or punishment. But this response must be the same either way, must be tshuva. Even if it is happenstance, the reason they were subject to happenstance was due to their failure to live up to the incredible potential that we as humans have. But even beyond that, our response has to be the same. It has to be tshuva. Like we saw at the beginning, the Rambam of last time, Rambam Hilchos Taanios, that we can't say it's nikra nikres. Rather, we have to say biglal maaseinu harayim, these things happen. And so, in the end of the day, it's a very fascinating machlokas, but perhaps there's not really that much of a nafkamina. I want to think about the Rambam's Mahalich a little more broadly. You know, an interesting question is that why is it that the Rambam and some other Rishonim felt that, you know, rejected this approach that everything is min hashamayim, that there's no such thing as teva. Could be that certain aspects of the Rambam's theories stem from philosophical or scientific assumptions that we don't find compelling anymore. And if that's true, where does it leave us? I think one thing that many people have a difficulty with in the Rambam is his strong emphasis on the intellectual connection to God. Not everybody is equally endowed in that respect. And this might be one of the reasons why, like we said, many, many thinkers prefer a more pervasive approach to providence. And one could even sort of dismiss the Rambam's view and say, you know, it's just because it's rooted in his Aristotelian conception of the universe. But I don't think that's correct. In other words, you know, somebody could say, look, Naniach, this is what the Rambam holds. I would never reject the Rambam's Taich interpretation of the Gemara Bava Kamma, Gemara Shabbos, but I'll reject his approach to Hashgacha because, you know, that's coming from outside of the Torah. But I don't think that that's so simple. If you had a chance to look at the Rambam's writings on this, I think it's clear that his view on providence largely comes from his understanding of Torah and Torah sources. In the end of the day, the Rambam rejects Aristotle's view in favor of the position that the Torah articulates. And indeed, interestingly enough, I guess we're not going to get to it today, but even though the Ramban disagrees with many aspects of the Rambam's Mahalich, he too seems to distinguish between the type of providence experienced by righteous people and less righteous people. So I don't think, you know, the Ramban is certainly not motivated by the Greeks when he seems to allow for that limitation. So I don't think we can just ignore the Rambam. So we have to try to understand it. It might not be the main Mahalich, at least nowadays, but it's something that we do have to understand and try to learn properly. So with 6 minutes left, we are ready to begin today's topic, which is the Ramban on Hashgacha. So we're not really going to be able to do that today, but we'll begin with a very famous quote, and we'll have to figure out what it means another time. And this is the Ramban from his Hakdama to Sefer Yov. Like the Ramban felt that much of what we have to learn in terms of Hashgacha can be found in Sefer Yov. The Ramban has a commentary on the book of Yov. It's printed in Kisvei Ramban. And he writes like this. Again, this is now in today's Ma'amar Kamos, which says the Hakdama to Yov. Davar Yadua, ki ha'emuna b'yidiyas ha'kel yisborach, b'minei ha'shvalim v'ishayhem, v'ashkachaso b'klalim uv'pratim, pinos gedolos mitoras Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha'shalom. Ki ha'kofer b'zeh, kofer b'torah b'chlal, someone who denies Hashgacha is denying Torah. V'chein ha'kofer b'ashkacha, shi'omar she'en ha'bori mashkiach b'vnei adam, im ya'asu tov ha'ora, someone who says HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't mashkiach, if a person does good, does bad, v'im yashkiach, im yasigem davar, ha'kol mikra lahem, and things happen to a person, it just happenstance, lo b'chefetz aloka, so not because of the desire of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his intention. Gam lezeh ein chelak l'olam haba. Someone who basically denies Hashgach has no chelak l'olam haba. V'lo zichron mistaka b'torah, lo b'mitzvoseha, lo b'yudehem. Someone who denies Hashgach, even if he does the mitzvos, has no chelak l'olam haba. He won't get even a zchus or tztaka from his mitzvos that he does. It's a fascinating idea. Person who does mitzvos but lacks correct emunos, the mitzvos are worthless, he seems to be saying here. Ki lo yichavein aleihem, because when he does those mitzvos, he's not going to be mechavein to them because of his kfira, including kfira and hashkacha. Ve'af lo benivuah, he's basically denying the idea of prophecy, because prophecy clearly takes for granted that Hashem is involved in the world. Ki anivua hashkacha gdol v'emes. Nivua is taka, tremendous hashkacha. So the Rambam tells us that, tells us that denial of hashkacha not only constitutes absolute heresy, but someone who denies it has no chelik and olam haba, even if they've done mitzvos. So we really need to understand the mahalich of the Ramban on Hashgacha. And so we're going to leave you all with a cliffhanger, and we'll have to stop here. And Be'ezras Hashem, we'll pick up next semester. So now I'll just make a couple of announcements concerning the Bechina and also next semester. And then if anyone has questions, either about the Torah or about the non-Torah things, feel free to ask.